Good morning.
Good morning.
Congratulations. You all made it this morning. I almost didn't. My smartphone was smarter than me. I remembered a couple of days ago, but it figured it out and woke me up. So I'd like to continue, jump back a couple of weeks, and see if I can finish up Dogen's fascicle, rather difficult but beautiful fascicle on Uji, time being, which is maybe appropriate, you know, for today. I didn't time it this way, but, you know, the equinox, the turning of the season, the turning somehow, you know, helping us pay more attention to time, you know, sort of arbitrarily setting it back and forward and kind of shocks us a little bit, you know, like, oh, what is this thing we call time? And that's what Dogen is trying to do with this fascicle. He's trying to get us to think about time and course in time differently and appreciate time. And, you know, you could pick anything. You know, you could pick a flower or light or anything and go more deeply into it. And so the word I like is like deep time. Dogen is trying to get us to see deep time, not our conventional. There's conventional time that we need. You know, we look at the watch, it's sequential, it's 8:45, it's going to be 9. But there's a different way, there's a deep time. And I was thinking in meditation today, what he's saying is true. You know, it's coming out of his meditative experience that when you're there, you're floating in time. Memories come up of the past. And then if you follow them and go into them, you access the emotion of that time. This person did this to me, or this happened, and you can feel the emotion of that event coming up again. And then you can let it go, and you can think of the future. Something's happening, and anxiety can be created, or some pleasure state can be created, and you're drifting in your meditation between these states, right? So in some ways, that's what Dogen is saying. These are flowing. The past is influencing the present, right? The present is influencing the future. The future is influencing now. He even says now is influencing the past. I had to think about that one for a while. How does the present influence the past? Well, one way when I work with people in grief and incidents that happened to you in the past, you're constantly reprocessing them and looking at them, hopefully, in a new perspective, in a spiritual perspective. And what was maybe problematic in the past no longer becomes so problematic. So today is actually, your meditation today is influencing the past. That's one way to look at it. A couple of weeks ago, I remember, time just flows, doesn't it? But I was reading a list of everyday mindfulness, how to be mindfulness, and I did make a few copies, and if they're gone, I'll make some more. And I was reflecting on how in a monastic setting where you're practicing very intensely, most of the day is about developing some sense of concentration and mindfulness in everyday activities with it, in trying to engender a sense of gratitude, a sense of connectivity to everything. Everything you touch, you know, your food, the knife, your robes, everything, you're trying to be mindful about how does that create a more appreciative view of the world that you live in and how it supports you. And all monastic schedules try to do that. You get up in the morning, you say a little chant, you do this. So there was a list just in everyday mindfulness about how that can happen. This particular list doesn't, it leaves it to your own conclusion about how just mindfulness in itself will create a sense of gratitude. So I went through the whole list. There were so many things. Somebody here said, wow, so many things to remember. You know, I sort of flooded you. But let me just do the first three, maybe every week. When you first wake up in the morning, before you get out of bed, bring your attention to your breathing. for at least 5 full breaths, letting the breath do itself, appreciating your breath, its life force. Notice your body posture. Be aware of how your body and mind feel when you move from lying down to sitting, to standing, to walking. How are they connected? How is the body and the mind connected? Not separate, you know. When you hear a phone ring, a bird sing, a train pass by, laughter, a car horn, the wind or the sound of a door closing, use it. Or any other sound to remind you to come fully in the here and now. So when you meditate, sometimes, you know, when I'm walking, I say, okay, I'm just going to pay attention to my hearing right now for the next 10, 20 breaths. And then suddenly, what you hadn't heard comes more vividly into relief. So these practices are really essential and important in our spiritual life. So most of, as you, like in a monastic setting and more in your life, I hope this is what happens. But then Dogen will sit down and give a Dharma talk, you know, which is, he doesn't talk about the specifics so much. He's talking very broadly. He's trying to create a feeling, an atmosphere of inspiration for you about how to approach your life. So we've been studying his fascicle on Uji, and he's using this time as a way to think about how all things, you know, all things are connected. Every moment of time. And he says, and by way of review, first of all, begin to doubt, you know, the sense of doubt that we bring. What is this? What is this thing we call time, this doubt that's important in our practice? What could this be? Sense of wonderment, you know. Don't just think of time as going from past to future. And then he introduces the idea of flowing. Think of life as flowing, as not a hindering. And more can we bring our life into alignment with that. The sense of flowing, non-hindrance of time, you know. And so I wanted to just, again, because this is so not so easy to understand. And then he uses the metaphor of time as being like the realm in the realm of form. In his great sutra that Gary Snyder comments on in his great kind of opus on Mountains and Rivers Sutra about how the mountains and rivers are flowing. They flow. Don't think of them as something static. Think of them as time, that everything is flowing in time. Know that in this way, there are myriad forms and hundreds of grasses through, or flowers, you know, throughout the entire earth. And yet each grass and each form itself is the entire earth. You find everything in every specific. The study of this is the beginning of practice. When you are at this place, there is just one grass, there is one form. There is understanding in form and non-understanding. In other words, go beyond what you think is understanding of form. There is understanding of grasses and no understanding of grasses. Since there is nothing but this moment, the time being is all the time there is, this time being. Grass being, form being, all are the same, both the same. Each moment is all being. Each moment is all being, is the entire world. Reflect now whether any being or any world is left out of the present moment. So imagine if your life was led that way, that each moment is complete. Each moment includes everything that you need. Each moment, in an absolute sense, is perfect. That's what he's trying to tell you. That's where he's trying to bring your mind to this place. Do not think that time merely flies away. Do not see flying away as the only function of time. If time merely flies away, you would be separate from time. The reason you do not clearly understand the time being is you think of time as only passing. In essence, all things in the entire world are linked with one another as moments. Because all moments are the time being, they are your time being. again, the sense of bringing things together in unity. And although the views of the ordinary person and the causes and conditions of those views are what the ordinary person sees, they are not necessarily the ordinary person's truth. You may think your time being or your being is not truth. You believe that the 16-foot golden body is not you. So what he's saying here is your belief is what limits you. Your belief about your own limitations. So this is a huge change from early. You know, early Buddhism was like really focus on your limitations, work on your limitations, and get over your limitations, right? Kind of a sense of, you know, you're always working to perfect yourself. So the Mahayana, this point of view that Dogen is saying, of course, in a monastic setting, you are working. And if you make some mistake and you're not mindful enough, there's going to be somebody there, especially in Japanese monasteries, that's going to correct you about how to do it. But he's saying here, that's one part of practice. But what I'm saying here is believe in your potential. Believe that you, because time being is accessible to you right now, all you have to do is open to it. It's right here for you. Trust that you are actually the Buddha. Begin to believe that you're the Buddha right now. And you manifest more and more your Buddha nature. Then he says, the time being of all beings throughout the world in water and on land is just the actualization of your complete effort right now. All beings of all kinds in the visible and invisible realms are the time being actualized by your complete effort, flowing due to your complete effort. Closely examine this flowing. Without your complete effort right now, nothing would be actualized, nothing would flow. So this is his great seminal point, practice realization. The time being exists, right? It exists. But you don't appreciate time being without trying to actualize it. So even though your Buddha nature exists, you have to actualize it. You have to actualize it through your complete effort in each moment. So both of those come together. So that's, and he brings that point through again and again. So here's a story that he goes on in section 16. He says, and at first this won't make much sense to you, okay? So, Yoshan was sent by his teacher, Shito, to study with Matsu. Matsu was one of the great, you know, Tang Dynasty Zen masters. He asked, I am familiar with the Buddha's basic teaching, but what is the main point of Zen? What is the main point of teaching? Why am I here? Again and again, this question comes up again and again, which we should ask. You know, why am I here? What am I doing? What's the main purpose of life? You know, what is it? And Matsu says, for the time being, have him raise his eyebrows and wink. For the time being, don't have him raise his eyebrows and wink. For the time being, have him raise his eyebrows and wink is right. For the time being, to have him raise his eyebrows and wink is not right. Hearing this, Yashan understood and said, when I was studying with Shitu, I was like a mosquito trying to bite the iron bowl. So, you know, what, a little more Zen, like, what on earth is this talking about? Mm-hmm. So if you really study the classics, you know what this is referring to is sort of one of the first koans. It's the one of the most important koans, which is Buddha gave a Dharma talk, and I've actually given this Dharma talk a couple years ago, where Buddha, the assembly was there, Buddha took the Dharma seat, he took a flower and he held it up, and that was his Dharma talk. He just held the flower up. And he looked around, and one person in the audience looked at the flower, Mahakashapa, in the back, and Mahakashapa smiled. and Buddha winked. No, so there are many things that are said in this Dharma talk. One is that the teaching is beyond anything you can say verbal. It's a completely non-verbal teaching. So that's kind of interesting and important. The second thing is it has something to do with something very concrete, like a flower. But it could be anything, really, that he holds up. So there's an acknowledgement right there what was being said. And Buddha was saying is, what he was really saying was, you know, Zen is not about, practice isn't about some thing in your head. It's about how you relate to things, how you are in the world. How do you relate to this flower? How do you relate to anything? So what Buddha is trying to say is one of his very early teachings was, when you see, just see. When you smell, just smell. When you hear, just hear. And in meditation practice, that's what we're training ourselves to do. Come back again and again to this immediate raw experience of your life, this fresh raw experience. Just this flower. How do you relate to whatever is in front of you? Without so much discursive a distortion. All that is said in that one effort. Hold the flower up. But what he does is he says, well, that's fine. And sometimes this is appropriate and sometimes this isn't appropriate. And what he's saying there is that, and then we're saying that even though that teaching is true, sometimes that teaching may be appropriate and sometimes it isn't. So that's another important part of the teaching. And that is that don't try to set up some kind of doctrine or dogma that's appropriate in every situation. And that's one thing I always appreciate about the teaching of Zen. And that's what Dogen is saying here. He's not trying to create, as many spiritual teachings do, a sense of dogma that this, it has to be this way. Figure it out and this is exactly the way to do it. And if it isn't this way, you're deviating and you're a heretic. He's saying, yeah, it's right here. It's not right here. Maybe it's appropriate. Maybe it isn't appropriate. You're the one that has to figure it out. What actually is. How you use time being. And he goes on to say, later on I'll get to that quote, where he says, don't try to even concretize the idea of time. He says, time isn't some substance. It isn't something like you can hang on to. He says, what I'm trying to get you to see is that time is really nothing. And because it's nothing, it's everything. And he goes on. Matsu's expression is unique. Eyebrows and eyes are mountains and oceans. Mountains and oceans are eyebrows and eyes. So again, he's going back to this idea again about something concrete in the world. Something. And that, again, every object of the world, every mountain, every ocean, is exactly as it is. It is the whole of truth. So everything in our lives, every moment, is the whole of truth. Even if we could enter. If only we could enter that particular moment. So on an absolute level, and this is an important teaching, is there's an absolute way to look at things in a relative way. And because we're always looking at things in a relative way, between good and bad, right and wrong, past and future, we're stuck in that realm. And that's a realm that's important to understand. You know, it really informs our life. But he's trying to show you that time is, he's trying to show us and move us into a realm of more of the absolute. You know, about how to look at time in that realm. That everything, because it is as it is, right in this moment, includes everything. And because of that, it's perfect as it is. And on a relative side, we do need to make choices. We do need to look at our watch. We do need to figure out that it's the equinox and we need to get up, you know, at a different time. Here's a beautiful quote. He goes on to kind of elaborate on this point. Mountains are time and oceans are time. If not, there would not be mountains and oceans. Don't think of mountains and oceans as one thing and time as something else. There is no other time but what it is rising now. If there were, time would be canceled out and mountains and rivers would not exist. But time is never canceled out and mountains and oceans arise. And that's why Buddha sees the morning star. He's enlightened. That's why Buddhas become enlightened. And raise the flower, like Buddha does to Mahakashapa. Seeing the flower, Mahakashapa raises his eyebrows and the Buddha winks. This is time. This is every moment of time. This is the depth, the isness, the echo of time. All of time, all of the time being, for the time being. God, it's really, I mean, you don't completely know what he's, it's actually very profound. So when Gary, you know, Gary Snyder is writing his poems on Mountains and Rivers Sutra, the whole thing is about a story of his life and about the turning of time and about beginning to see mountains as something alive, seeing everything that we think is being static is actually flowing and alive. Then Dogen goes on. Zen master Guiying of Shi is the heir of Shuyang, a descendant of Lin Ji, one of the other great Zen masters. One day he taught this. For the time being, remember, Dogen isn't just coming up with this idea of time being. He's actually drawing from people in the past about this idea of working with time being. For the time being, awakening arises, but not expression. For the time being, expression arrives, but not awakening. For the time being, both awakening and expression arrive. For the time being, neither awakening nor expression arrive. So again, he's doing that kind of, it's right here, it's not right here. And so Dogen will often be doing that to you, you know, so you don't get just stuck in one perspective. And so what he's saying here is this is saying something about actually spiritual practice. He's saying that in the first one, in the stages of our practice, we begin to have a sense of what maybe emptiness is, about the interconnectedness of things. And we begin to feel our heart open. Or we sense that there's something we could do, but we don't know what. So we have a sense of truth, but we don't know how to express it. And again, as I said, then is it actually about action? It's actually about how you are. It's about how you express your character in the world. So the first one, you begin to sense it, but you don't know what to do. Maybe you just show up at meditation and you sit on your cushion. You feel your heart kind of open and crack a little bit, but you don't quite know what to do. Then the second phrase is that you begin to express it. Begin to try to express it. And in this instance, you'll find, for example, there are many examples of this, and I'm sure you've found that when people start to practice, they get very enthusiastic, you know. And they'll start telling people, you know, I get up at 5 o'clock and I meditate in the morning and God, it really makes me feel great. Or if you're in a monastic setting, you'll see that people are like overly mindful. Like they'll be very precise about how they do things. Too precise. You know, like Suki Roshi looked at some Zen teacher, he says, he's sitting too straight. You know what I mean? There's too much ego involved in your practice. And we all go through this. You know, we all go through this thing about how, you know, maybe we walk extra slow or, you know, there's a way it sort of calls attention to you in a way that's not appropriate. So that's kind of the second stage. Then the third stage is that you actually begin more and more to be able to just live it more naturally. That you sense there is some need in the world and you respond to it. Maybe you say, well, this is an opportunity for me to practice patience or to practice generosity or to practice loving kindness. And I'm actually going to go out and do it, you know. But in this stage, there's still, and hopefully most of us get to this stage, and most of us hang out in this stage, hopefully most of the time, finding ways to express our practice. But there's still, it's still a little bit tainted by our sense of accomplishment or doing or goal-oriented. And so the fourth stage is that there's no trace. And you see this again and again in literature, spiritual literature, where somebody is just, their life is just flowing. They have practiced so long that it just happens naturally. They don't have any sense that they're doing something right. They don't even have a sense that they're enlightened. They often say, you know, the enlightened person doesn't know they're enlightened, right? Because enlightenment is some idea you have of yourself, right? Or you have some idea that this is right and this is wrong. You're just flowing naturally in the world. So I'm trying to think, you know, sometimes we can move into that space. I had a friend once who was walking down Salmon Creek, and he actually got the Dale Carnegie Award, you know, civilian award for saving, doing something great. You know, they give them out every year. He was walking down Salmon Creek, and somebody got swept out by one of those sweeper waves, and he jumped into the ocean and swam out and brought the person back. Philip Buehler, maybe some people know him. He's really quite a good artist. He used to live here in Sebastopol for many years. And I talked to him about it, and he says, I just didn't have any sense, you know, and you often read that in the paper. Well, I didn't know. I just, the building was burning, and I just ran in. I wasn't trying to be a hero. Kind of coming more for that kind of a place. You know? Not like, I'm going to be a hero, so I'm going to go do it. Just do it. But you don't do that unless you've spent your life training, that you get to that place where it's just spontaneous. And later you're not taking any credit for it. You know, it's just what people do, right? Didn't anybody do this? Kind of that place. So that's kind of the fourth stage. Then Dogen says, as we're nearing the end here, so now Dogen goes on to explain, both awakening and expression, both this awakening and the expression of awakening, are the time being. Both the arriving of the awakening and the expression and the non-arriving of awakening and expression are also the time being. Before a moment arrives, its non-arriving is already here. So it's not so easy to understand that. But what he's trying to get you to do is you sort of struggle with that phrase a little bit. I mean, I like the beauty of the language, actually. I can sense the truth of it when I read it, even though I don't quite know what he's trying to get at. But what he's trying to get at is don't objectify time again. Don't try to create, don't make it into something. Don't make it into a dogma or a doctrine. Think of it as a mystery. Like emptiness. You know, don't make emptiness into something. You can work with it, you know, but think of it more as a mystery. So we don't want to objectify it. That's what he's saying here. This whole fascicle is not about creating something that you can hang on to. If anything, he's saying you can hang on to time. He's trying to say, don't struggle with it. So I think that if you were to sum up Uji's time being, what the teaching tells us is that every moment of being alive, you know, of entering deep time, is completely embracing everything, being embraced by everything. There is no way not to be sharing the joy of life, moment after moment, with everything. That's the place where he's trying to bring us, in a sense of time being. And you've all experienced that, right? When you're there in your meditation practice, when things can quiet and still in your mind, lest you just be open, and you're there just appreciating everything is all right with the world, on an absolute level. On a relative level, yeah, you know, there are a million trillion things that could be better. and that you could work with to alleviate suffering in the world. But it's being informed by this other place where you're in time being and everything is all right. So, and we can express that in the world. And how we express that in the world makes a huge difference in terms of how things change and how we change and what kind of influence we have on our lives and other people. So we practice mindfulness and we practice meditation. Meditation opens us up, brings us to the still point, and then hopefully we're more mindful and more appreciative about how time flows around.